Actually, Rodrigo and I have sort of bumped into each other shortly before he defended his PhD, which in Spain is quite an affair with a tribunal. So this auditorium here cannot be frightening. And it very much links some of the things we've just heard about in a different context. So without further ado, please go ahead with your presentation.
Thank you.
Yes, so I need this before. I'm very happy to be here, and I want to thank you for giving me the chance to present this work, which I think is very linked to what Elsa and you have been doing. But I will try to approach it from a different angle. So in this paper, what I want to share is our take on how a large-scale approach can be used to show the complexity of current policy about intellectual property rights associated to traditional knowledge. And well, this is a work that we have been doing with Narell from Bolivia, as well as Jens Christian and Henrik Balslev from Denmark, and Manuel, my PhD supervisor in Spain. Okay, so over the last decades, as we all know, the research done by ethnobotanists, anthropologists, as well as the recognition of indigenous people's rights has really put traditional knowledge in the forefront of programs of important NGOs, as well as bigger treatises like the Convention on Biological Diversity and the more recent IPBES. And in our study region, also very interesting is the declaration of the traditional knowledge of the Jaguar shamans of Yurubari from the Colombian Amazon as intangible cultural heritage of humanity, which from Spain I knew, for example, that flamenco is one of these things. But for me, it was surprising to find that these people with whom I worked, it's also within this framework. So quite nice, the evolution of the recognition of traditional knowledge. And well, traditional knowledge has been used to accelerate drug discovery, and of course, as a result, it has promoted big bioprospecting efforts, which have led to intense debates about intellectual property rights already from the 1990s to nowadays in big journals like Nature. And so, as Elsa and Françoise were saying, the Nagoya Protocol was formulated in 2010, although it's not yet implemented, to try to address biopiracy and misappropriation of genetic resources. And it tries to emphasize prior informed consent and mutually agreed upon terms for benefit sharing with the communities and governments. And there are two interesting articles within the Nagoya Protocol, which is Article 10 on a global multilateral benefit sharing mechanism, as well as Article 11, which try to tackle this concept of when traditional knowledge about genetic resources is shared across different parties, how parties can do to share the benefits that may arise from using this traditional knowledge. So quite an important concept, but as we will see, there's not too much science behind this. And well, in addition, over the last decades, there has been the development of traditional knowledge databases, especially in India. This has been pioneered to provide evidence of prior knowledge to patent examiners as a means to limit the granting of patents based on non-original innovations. And after forcing the US Patent Office to withdraw a patent on turmeric, India's Scientific Research Council set up the Traditional Knowledge Digital Library as a protective mechanism, as Elsa also mentioned. And finally, just to mention another of these initiatives, is that led by the WIPO, the World Intellectual Property Organization, where they set up an intergovernmental committee on intellectual property and genetic resources, traditional knowledge, and folklore. and where they are currently developing international legal instruments to try to promote the protection of traditional knowledge and expressions of culture. But despite all this very nice paperwork and policy making, we argue that actually we know very little, and just the multi-scale and inter-ethnic comparisons that are needed to really understand what's the spatial structure of knowledge are currently missing. And so all of this policy is a bit in an information vacuum. So the objectives of our work was to analyze how much traditional knowledge is shared about medicinal uses across multiple scales. And we did this first across four countries, then across two broad cultural groups, so on the one hand indigenous, and on the other hand non-indigenous groups, 52 tribes with whom we had information, six non-Amerindian groups, 41 communities, and then individuals within those communities. And we focus on Northwest South America, which is a nice region because it's considered to have the richest flora on Earth, so it has high bioprospecting potential. There have been high levels of traditional knowledge documented in the region, and there's also a high probability of exchange of traditional knowledge brought about the widespread use of Spanish and Portuguese, as well as the increasing mobility of these groups, indigenous and non-indigenous. We chose palms as our model group, the palm family, for various reasons. First, because they are widely distributed in Northwest South America, so they are found in the Amazon, the Andes, and the Chocó, where we worked. They have high species richness, so they, currently we know that there are about 332 species found in Colombia, Ecuador, Peru, and Bolivia, and a very high percentage of endemics as well. Their taxonomy has been well studied, and we have excellent field guides at the country level and also at the American scale. And we have found that they have high medicinal potential, despite what was thought a few decades before. Already, Plotkin and Balik started to call on the importance of palms for medicine, and now a more recent review has almost doubled the number of recognized medicinal palm species. So for this study, we first did a 12-month bibliographic review of works about palm uses, which was published in 2011. And we reviewed 255 works, which had information from 53 indigenous groups, Afro-Americans, which normally live in the Colombian and Ecuador Pacific region, and mestizos. And once we did this review, we set out to do field interviews. And during 18 months, we were two students, one student who worked in Bolivia and Peru, and I worked in Colombia and Ecuador. We gathered about 2,200 interviews in 68 communities, and also indigenous groups, Afro-Americans and mestizos. And in this map, you can see those ethnic groups in black are the indigenous groups with information only registered in the literature, while those groups in red are the groups that had no information in the past in the literature, but which we were able to interview in the field. And the numbers in blue are groups with information from both sources. Okay. And, well, overall, we use this data for other papers as well, but for this one, we had 58 references with medicinal uses associated and about 1,400 interviews, which gave about 86 palm species and 503 medicinal uses. And we classified all this information following Cook's data collection standard with some modifications for tropical regions. And very important, we also define what's a palm use to be able to perform our comparisons as the use of a species of one of its palm parts, in our case, in this study, for a medicinal category and within a use subcategory. So, for example, the use of the fruits of Oenocarpus batawa for medicinal purposes and specifically for dental health. That would be one use. Here are the different use subcategories within the medicinal category. And, okay, so our results. First, regarding countries, we found that about 84% of all uses were not shared across countries. So there was high levels of unique registers within each country, which was surprising to us. And with Colombia and Bolivia being the countries with the highest percentage of unique uses, or what we call singletons. Then, regarding the two broad cultural groups, indigenous and non-indigenous groups, we found also a similar trend, with about 80% of all uses being restricted to one of the groups, and with Amerindians having the highest proportion of singletons. Then, for the 52 analyzed tribes, we also found high levels of unique registers within tribes, although there was about 27% of uses that were shared across tribes. And the Ticuna from the Colombian Amazon, the Leko from the Bolivian Andes, and the Huaorani from the Amazonian Ecuador were the groups with the highest levels of singletons. And then finally, for the last group of non-Amerindians, we also found high levels of singletons, with mestizos from Bolivia and Afro-Colombians having the highest percentage of singletons. And then we downscaled a bit more the analysis to the community level, and we just show here the 41 communities which met our criteria that they have at least 10 individuals belonging to one ethnic group, because some communities were from mixed groups. And what you see here in each subfigure is at the top the number of the community, so following a latitudinal gradient from 1 in the north to 41 in the south. The bar on the left is the number of unique uses only reported in that community, and the bar on the right is the number of shared uses with other communities. And here we found that in contrast to the other patterns, a bit over 50% of uses were shared with other communities. And we went on to look the amount of unique and shared medicinal knowledge, but between communities of the same ethnicity. And we had 8 ethnic groups, which met the criteria of having 2 communities sampled, at least in our fieldwork. And here we found that for 6 of the 8 groups, most medicinal uses were not shared between their communities, which you can see here. And for those 2 other ethnicities that did share over 50% of their uses, they had very low number of medicinal uses. And then finally, at the individual level, in each community, we compared the number of uses cited by less than 10% of individuals in the community, which is the bar on the left, and the number of uses cited by more than 50% of individuals. And here, it was quite surprising as well that it was only 6 communities where the number of uses was cited by over... cited by over 50% of informants was greater than the number of uses cited by less than 10% of informants. So this comes to show that knowledge is quite idiosyncratic in these communities. And so we were interested in looking at what happens between the richness of knowledge in a community and the number of singletons reported by less than 10% of interviewees. And we found that they are significantly correlated. So the more knowledge you have in a community, the more idiosyncratic this knowledge becomes and the less shared. And then we went on to see which if there are differences in the number of unshared uses cited by different age groups, by men and women, and by general and expert informants. And surprisingly, we found that neither age or gender showed differences, and only we found significant differences between experts and general informants. But surprisingly, general informants cited a higher number of unique uses. And here I have to say that experts were selected by community members, so not by us. Okay, so, well, we think that this work is interesting because it shows the importance of conducting local interviews in communities, but using a common method so that we can do large-scale comparisons so that we can understand better the structure of traditional knowledge, and in this case, related to intellectual property, and the high levels of unique traditional knowledge at the country level show that, well, it's definitely important for national mechanisms to develop, to protect this knowledge. But as some authors have said before, in this case Elvin Lewis, there are some problems with the current laws. And for example, the Peruvian law, as Elsa knows very well, has some flaws in that it only considers, for example, Amerindian groups to be traditional knowledge custodians. So they initially just dismiss all other non-indigenous groups. And mestizos are the largest population in the Amazon. It also designates unrealistic fees that are unattractive to pharmaceuticals. Also, the mechanisms needed to be able to track companies' reliance on traditional knowledge have not been implemented. And it also requires assembling the collective traditional knowledge of Peru, which is a massive, massive task. However, we also found that there are some knowledge that is shared. And so this supports the international, global, multilateral benefit sharing mechanisms. I don't have too much time to speak about this minority of shared knowledge now. There's a lot of work to be done in the region. It's going to be massive to compile the remaining traditional knowledge, if it's even going to be possible, so that policy can actually be coherent. For example, we found that 50% of indigenous groups in our study area have never been documented in the past. And those that have, we found that their knowledge has been severely underdocumented. So there are huge information gaps. There are some promising country-wide examples, and we have seen the case of Peru, but I think it's also interesting the case of India, the People's Biodiversity Register initiative, when they have been for several decades compiling the traditional knowledge and with a standard format, besides the digital library they set up. And so, well, our next step is to try to propose this new study using Colombia as a pilot country, where we will try to set priorities for countrywide documentation. But it's quite difficult because it has a high ethnic diversity with almost 100 groups living in almost 700 reserves. So we must set priorities, and we think that we have to include different criteria. For example, one can be language endangerment. So here we find all of Colombia's languages classified according to language endangerment. So, for example, the Cubeo language is in a good state, but the Caricona is dying. So we would argue that we must start working with these groups first. But not us, but they should do it. And we're trying to incorporate some citizen science into this framework and see if we can launch a national program to do this. Also integrate maybe other criteria like population census data. For example, Elsa was mentioning how they interview informants over 50 years old. So there are some available data at the department level, but I think also at the municipality level. So we have to see how we can integrate this, and maybe some indicators of accessibility and biodiversity levels. Yeah. And well, that's all I wanted to say, and it's been possible to do this work thanks to all my friends and informants from the communities who were really excited about this. We got the money from the PAMS project, financed by the EU, and as well as the university in Spain and Denmark. And just want to give some thanks to all the people who I work with, and to you all. Thank you.